From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, horror and freedom in Cleveland, Ohio. Hackers hit the banks. Israel hits Syria. On Monday, Amanda Berry, kidnapped 10 years ago, one of three women held captive, finally broke out of the house that served as a prison in Cleveland. Here is her 911 call.
Barry.
You need police, fire, ambulance.
I need police.
Okay, and what's going on there?
I've been kidnapped and I've been missing for 10 years and I'm here. I'm free now.
Benghazi, back in House hearings. Former Deputy Chief of Mission in Libya, Gregory Hicks, said he was stunned when UN Ambassador Susan Rice said a video caused the violence.
I was stunned. My jaw dropped. And I was embarrassed.
And a damning new report on sexual assault in the U.S. military on the heels of the arrest of a key Air Force officer on assault charges. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and many others were livid.
If the man in charge for the Air Force in preventing sexual assault is being alleged to have committed a sexual assault this weekend, obviously there's a failing in training and understanding of what sexual assault is and how corrosive and damaging it is to good order and discipline.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Sanger of the New York Times, Elizabeth Sullivan of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. What are you thinking on Cleveland, hackers, Syria, Benghazi? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us from Washington is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, winner of two Pulitzer Prizes, author of last year's Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David Sanger, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And from Cleveland, Ohio, Elizabeth Sullivan is here, editorial page editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Elizabeth, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Tom.
And from
having me.
Good to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty is here. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Elizabeth.
Incredible scenes from your town this week, Elizabeth. I mean, first, just the sound of these reports coming out, and then the house, the scene, the whole story. Unbelievable. Here's Amanda Berry. We heard her voice there in that incredible 911 call. Here's her cousin, Destiny Sneed, moved to tears, recounting how she said her family never gave up hope that Amanda would be fine. Speaking here with ABC affiliate in Cleveland, WEWS-TV.
We love her and we missed her for 10 whole years, and I thought about her every day. And
every
I knew
day,
she would come.
Day.
I knew she would come home.
You never gave up hope.
Never gave up hope. Because I know she's just like us. We don't give up.
But this response as well, this is Juan Perez, Elizabeth. This was a neighbor of Ariel Castro, the chief suspect in the Cleveland assault and kidnapping and more case, telling Cleveland's WEWS again that he grew up two houses from the house where the three women were held for nearly a decade. He said that the news is hard on the neighborhood.
I know I'm not the only one on the block that feels ashamed that we didn't notice anything. I mean, I feel like my head's low. Work at a school, work with kids, you know, I have a heavy heart right now.
Elizabeth, how is Cleveland taking this on board that right in the heart of the city for all these years you had this horror show going on?
You know, I think your two sound bites kind of capture the range of emotions here, from the exhilaration, the vindication of those who were looking for two of the three women. We reported this morning on the case of Michelle Knight, the third woman, why her disappearance had not been publicized and was not known about, because the police had taken her name off a missing persons list that the FBI maintains.
Incredible. Just 15 months after she was reported missing, she's off the missing persons list, but she's still alive and in this hellish situation.
Yes. But, you know, it was the case, and you heard that in Amanda Berry's initial 911 call, mm-hmm. that she knew people were looking, that this must have kept their spirits up, that there were annual vigils and people were still looking. But the bizarre part being, of course, that the families knew one another. This is one of the mechanisms by which Ariel Castro managed to kidnap these women, to persuade them to get into his vehicle, which is the means by which he kidnapped all three of them over the space of 3 years. But what the other neighbor said too is a lot of soul searching, not just in the neighborhood, but there's going to be a lot of scrutiny of the police department for how they handled this. Were there, you know, calls that they did not take seriously? Some of the neighbors have said so. It's not clear though whether that is, you know, sort of selective remembrance now that we know what was going on in that house.
But what are the police saying? I mean, we have this report of people calling in sightings of a woman, you know, naked on all fours in the backyard with a dog collar on.
The police, this is key. The police are saying that they have no such reports. Hmm. You know, as far as we can ascertain, no such reports have surfaced. That doesn't mean that they weren't made, but it does mean that you know, it's the police, these calls may not actually have been made. Maybe people saw it and thought they, you know, sort of in their mind they've created this. What's key is apparently the girls, the women, when they were interviewed by police, said that they only left the house twice and heavily disguised. So they don't recount the same scenes that the neighbors say that was reported. So you have to sort of, I think this will all be sorted out, you know, over time. But the context here that you have to understand is this is less than 4 years after a maybe even worse scene was uncovered in another house in Cleveland where a serial killer, Anthony Sowell, had been luring street women, rootless women to his home, raping and murdering them. 11 bodies were recovered from his house. He's been convicted. But that also went on over the course of many years and resulted in an enormous investigation of how the Cleveland police handle missing persons cases and cases of sexual assault, because there were a couple of women who escaped from Anthony Sowell whose cases were not taken seriously. There was a panel involving people from the community as well as a former police chief who came up with a series of recommendations, almost all of which the city has implemented. Nonetheless, you know, it remains the case, and I think you sort of almost see this, you know, in the larger context with the report about sexual assaults in the military, with the Steubenville rape case, that we as a society do not yet really take as seriously as we need to, cases of sexual assault, sexual exploitation. We need to protect, you know, our young women better than we do.
Is this, Jack Beattie, I wonder, looking at this, if this feels like one of those cultural watersheds moment, you know, this what's our culture coming to, you know, way back in New York when the woman was killed outside the apartment building and nobody responded. Here we've got, you know, women held captive in a neighborhood and nothing really happens. I don't know, Jack, do you see one of these, a class issue here, a what's our culture coming to issue here?
Well, certainly a what's our culture coming to, and it's hard to separate this from the pornography industry. I've been reading about that. It's a $30 billion industry online and heavily sadistic. Heavily sex is mixed with fantasies of domination and superiority. And that's got to be talked about. Clearly that's involved in the military disgrace. And here this demented character, malign character, putting to work some sort of fantasy about this. Let's hope it's a cultural watershed, but one wonders.
$8 million bail for Ariel Castro. He's reportedly said, Elizabeth Sullivan, that he's a sex addict, and then we have these charges, the murder charge. Is that there already for the forced miscarriages that he allegedly induced, provoked, beat and starved the women into?
The county prosecutor held a news conference yesterday, Tim McGinty, and said that he would seek aggravated murder charges against Ariel Castro for essentially beating. He punched, according to the women, the stomach of Michelle Knight, the woman who, I checked, was still in the hospital until she miscarried on several occasions. And the prosecutor has said that he will seek aggravated murder charges for those actions. So that is a death penalty case in Ohio.
David Sanger, there you are in your perch in Washington, watching the world, watching the country, watching this. What does it bring to mind, to heart, to this story out of Cleveland, David?
Well, beyond the obvious tragedy of it, and beyond the question of whether or not there were policing errors made both in the missing persons report, but also even in it turned out all right when you listen to that 9/11 tape, you have a 911 operator who sounds a little bit casual about it. Like, we'll see if there's a free car.
Yeah, a little dry, a little cool. On the other hand, maybe she's getting, there's a cat in my tree calls all day long.
Well, I was about to say, you have to give them some space for the fact that they get a lot of crazy calls, and this one obviously was not one.
Yeah.
But there is an issue of the isolation of American life, urban and suburban life, that you can have people living on a block and really have so little sense of what's going on, you know, right next door.
Even when the windows are boarded up and it looks, now it looks spooky.
I mean, when you look back at it with 2020 hindsight, there are all kinds of signals that go off. But of course, when we look back at 9/11, there are all kinds of signals that go off. You know, hindsight's a wonderful thing. But in this particular case, the mix of the boarding up, the porch light that was always on, the occasional scenes in the backyard, there does seem to be more than the usual amount of missed signals out here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news: Cleveland horror, Benghazi, sexual assault in the U.S. military, Israel hits Syria, hackers hit the banks. Elizabeth Sullivan is with us from Cleveland, editorial page editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. David Sanger's here, chief Washington correspondent at the New York Times. And Jack Beatty's here. Let's get our listeners on Cleveland. Elaine in Omaha, Nebraska is calling. Hi, Elaine. You're on the air.
Hi there. I think the deeper thing that we need to talk about when we talk about any kind of sexual problem is that sex is everywhere in our society. It's super saturated. Super Bowl is just covered with half-naked gyrating women, and we're broadcasting that to the whole world. And no wonder kids are confused about it, and sex and pornography is becoming a bigger and bigger industry all the time. And hardly anybody is talking to kids about the fact that sex should be, I think, in a relationship, and it should be private and not something that's blasted on television everywhere.
Here we are. I mean, sexuality is part of human nature, of course, is always within us, around us, but you're saying just too magnified, too open. Thanks for your call, Elaine. Elizabeth, what do you think? Too open, too free, too warped, or how do you see? Is there a bigger context that's a problem? Do you go with Jack in tying even pornography to your Cleveland case this week?
I personally wouldn't do that, though. We don't really know how, you know, Ariel Castro became such a, you know, twisted individual. This is a case more to me of exploitation of power. You know, rape is not really a sexual act. It's an act of power, of exerting power over somebody. And I think that, you know, we need to separate these two issues. I do think it is important that we educate our young people to protect themselves against exploitation. Most definitely, the statistics are pretty frightening that 1 in 5 American women at some point in their life will be sexually assaulted in some way. That's pretty frightening. But in this case, I think this is a power trip, and I think this is why, you know, in the military we have this chain of command issue, where, you know, many of the proposals coming out now to deal with this apparent increase in sexual assaults in the military, though it could just be more openness about reporting it, it does focus on changing, to whom you report it, because the chain of command does not seem to be handling it in the proper manner.
We definitely want to look at that. Mary in Hartford, Connecticut. Mary, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question about the situation in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. Why were the brothers of Ariel Castro not charged or indicted? They shared the same house. They had to be complicit in some way.
Let me ask, Elizabeth, why not? We've seen the two other brothers, and I don't know what their relationship was. No charges yet? If not, why not?
They actually lived in a different house. They lived, I believe, with their mother in a separate house. They were released charged with some minor infractions but released because the police, I guess, have determined that they actually did not know that Ariel Castro was holding these women. He rarely, I guess, let people into this house that he owned on Seymour Avenue. His children weren't aware of this. His former wife's partner felt that he was a suspicious sort, but most people who knew him thought he was just kind of a mild-mannered, kept to himself. He was a musician, played in some area bands. His father was very well-known. The whole family had come from Puerto Rico a couple of generations ago. I do think he was able, through various mechanisms, to keep people from finding out what was happening inside this house. And he apparently had intimidated the three women, Amanda Berry's accounts that have come out through the leaked police report indicate that he, would beat them. He would leave doors unlocked within the house, and he would beat them if they ventured out.
Yeah.
Yes.
Make
yes.
a move and you're in trouble. Francis in West Palm Beach, Florida. Francis, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, everybody.
Hi.
I've noticed in the last 10 to 15 years or so, I listen to the radio all the time, and then I've heard more and more ads on the radio for so-called gentlemen's clubs, and I've noticed kids' video games, they have very partially clad, helpless women, and even if they're warriors, they're very partially clad. And then also, if you put it together with the misogynistic comments by people like Limbaugh and other slips of the tongue by politicians, post-feminist era, it's still under the surface there that women are objects. And that's just how it seems to me.
Francis, we've got it. I mean, strip clubs and racy video games and all the rest, it's all out there. We've got a lot to look at. I want to move this. I mean, we're right up against it here, so let's go to the military. And I hate to, but it's been a big issue in the U.S. military in the last week. Big report coming out saying 20-some thousand incidents of sexual assault from their survey, up significantly from a year before when everybody was upset about it. And then, of course, the arrest of the guy who was the chief in the Air Force of watching out for sexual assault. Here's a little tape from NBC News of a U.S. Marine who was raped, Sarah Plummer, saying the current system for reporting and deciding sexual assault cases in the military does not work.
Having someone within your direct chain of command handling the case, it just doesn't make sense. It's like your brother raping you and having your dad decide the case.
The president talking big this week at a press conference standing next to the South Korean president about just what ought to happen here, but it may not be what does happen. Here's the president.
If we find out somebody's engaging in this stuff, they've got to be held accountable, prosecuted, stripped of their positions, court-martialed, fired, dishonorably discharged, period. It's not acceptable.
There's the president laying down the emotion and the rhetoric around this. But the fact is, David Sanger, that in the chain of command, even when the people are found guilty of sexual assault, it can be overruled. And there's a lot of talk of challenging this and changing this now, David.
Well, it's because you have two overlapping elements in the course of these investigations. If the complaint initially goes to somebody's commanding officer or someone in the chain of command, their first impetus is frequently how do you maintain harmony within a military unit and how do you avoid the embarrassment of reporting if this is happening under somebody's command, right?
Yep.
And so the point that was made in that clip that it makes no sense to have somebody within the chain of command be doing these investigations and be making a judgment on them is exactly right. So the reporting system has to start from the outside. I mean, this is why inspector generals exist, and it's why outside prosecutors exist and so forth. So the military's got to rethink completely how you would go do this and how you can make a complaint outside the chain of command without it affecting your status within that command.
I mean, this new report out, Defense Department estimating that more than 12,000 women on active duty were sexually assaulted last year. Out of 200,000 women in the armed forces, that's more than 1 in 20. Jack, almost 14,000 men sexually assaulted. Of course, that's out of more than 1 million. Still, these numbers are just kind of mind-blowing when you look at what we ask these people to do, and then we put them into a culture where this is going on.
Yes. And, you know, in studies, the military ranks, I think, is our most admired institution. And I think there's been a lot of, what, compensatory adulation of the military. I mean, we all say we honor your service. And, of course, we do. But what goes along with that can be a kind of blind eye turned on the conduct of people in the military, a kind of romantic gloss over the profession. And one of the things that glosses is the difference between people who volunteer for the military and people in civilian life. And there's one salient difference. This, according to studies, a 1996 study, another study, fully a third of military recruits report physical or sexual abuse as children. A third. That's as compared to 18% of people in the normal population.
Well, suggesting that they're enlisting and maybe in part to get away from some of that or to change their lives.
That's right. And that also, of course, as we know, being abused leads you to abuse. And I just don't think this is adequately talked about. There have been some books about it. Helen Benedict at Columbia wrote about the problem in Iraq. There's been an excellent documentary recently. But we need to look into this and to find out, you know, who is joining the military? What are their motives for doing it? And is this contributing in some way? I'm obviously not making any causal comment, but in some way, is that contributing to this culture of degradation?
Well, we certainly don't want to, you know, damn people who are abused as children. I mean, they've got to find a life. If it's in the military, it may be fine, but let's watch out. One more call on this. We've got much more to look at. Margaret in New Orleans. Margaret, thanks for calling.
Thank you. The situation with the three women held hostage is just heartbreaking. It's horrible. And you had a caller call in and say that pornography was part of the picture, and someone was trying to discount that. You cannot discount that it's part of the picture. You also cannot discount that 50 Shades of Grey, this book that all these women are reading and think is fabulous, is not part of the picture. You know, pornography is wrong, but 50 Shades of Grey is okay. And then also on to that horrible instance where the football players are being charged with rape.
Steubenville.
Now, yeah. Yes, that was a horrible incident. You know, I think you can tell from my voice that I'm a woman. And, you know, in high school, I remember one time passing out at a party, and I am confident that none of those football players that I was with touched me. Okay? But
now they have.
No. I mean,
yeah.
My incident.
I understand.
Nothing happened to me, thank God, because I was with good people. But, you know, what the media is not sharing about that incident, please correct me if I'm wrong, but they are being charged with rape under that state's laws, which means penetration of the vagina, not penetration of the vagina with a penis, okay?
Yeah.
So a lot of people are mistakenly thinking that they had sex with this woman. They penetrated the vagina.
Well, yeah, no, we got it. I mean, but that's the law, and they broke it, and it's pretty clear. We've talked about Steubenville. It's tough. We've got so much more to look at. I've got to turn a corner here. David Sanger, we want to know about Syria and what you see going on there. I mean, we had these strikes, apparently clearly by Israel, early in the week at high-value targets. We'll talk about what those were. We had John McCain coming right in the middle of that and saying, look, everything's escalating in Syria. We've got to get in there. Here's McCain. This is on Fox News Sunday.
The whole thing is escalating. As you may have noticed, the leader of Hezbollah committed to helping Bashar Assad. The conflict is spilling over into Lebanon and Jordan. The whole situation is becoming more and more expansive. And unfortunately, the red line that the President of the United States written was apparently written in disappearing ink.
All that going on, plus Moscow and Washington talking maybe about putting together talks that could lead to something, or maybe about Moscow giving stronger air defense systems to Assad in Syria. What is developing in Syria this week, David?
Well, Tom, Senator McCain is right. It is certainly escalating. We've already seen a conflict in which 70 to 80,000 people have died. Just to put this in a context, when the United States went into Libya on humanitarian grounds, by the president's own accounting in his speech in March of 2011, and of course we went in not on the ground but with air attacks at that time, he went in on the basis of saving lives. And if you take that speech and you try to then do the translation to Syria, it is hard to understand what justified going into Libya and staying this far from Syria. At the same time, the president is living in a land of very lousy options out here. Yes, he could arm the rebels, something that Senator McCain has argued for a long period of time. But the most effective fighters among those rebels are the Islamic extremists. And if you think the Benghazi hearing this week was, filled with disturbing revelations, imagine one next year on how the United States ended up, even if inadvertently, arming Islamic extremist rebels with possible ties to Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
So that option doesn't look so great.
No.
Okay. There's the option of going in and trying to destroy the chemical weapons stores. But if you hit chemical weapons from afar and from the air, you have the possibility of creating exactly the kind of disaster you were trying to prevent. That also doesn't look so fabulous. And then there's the third big option that's out here, which is one that by process of elimination I think is gaining some steam within the Pentagon and within the White House, which is if there is evidence of chemical weapons use by the state, and that evidence, as the president himself said, is still pretty murky, so that hasn't emerged yet, or of imminent use, then the U.S. and its allies could strike at the delivery systems that Assad would use. And those could include his missile systems. It could include his air force. It could include his air defense system.
Is that what Israel was apparently doing this week?
Well, Israel was doing something a little different, Tom. Israel was going after missiles, but they were making it pretty explicit to us that they were only going after those that they feared could be transferred to Hezbollah and therefore moved to Lebanon and used against Israel. I was just in Israel 2 weeks ago, and the Israeli military and the civilian leadership, they are very determined not to get involved in the middle of the Syrian civil war. At the same time, they're very determined not to let Hezbollah get much more sophisticated weaponry. And so I think you're seeing them go in on a very selected basis. But, you know, you can hit missile sites, Tom, and it would do nothing to stop the horror that has killed 80,000 or 70,000 people.
Is John Kerry right when he suggests that the Washington and Moscow may be on their way to organizing some kind of talks here, or is he... is he missing something? If, you know, Russia is also reported to be talking about giving more sophisticated air defenses to Syria, is the Secretary of State on it, or I don't know, one eye closed here?
Well, the big question is: are these talks to actually accomplish something, or are these talks designed to buy time
for Assad?
For Assad, right? So, in other words, if you're Russia or if you're Assad, do you agree to go into talks on the theory that no one can go in and take military action against you if there's a negotiating process underway? This, of course, has long been the suspicion that opponents of the talks with Iran have had, that the Iranians use the process quite skillfully to drag this on while in the background they are working on their nuclear program. In Assad's case, the question is, would he use it to drag it on while he's continuing the attacks that may well still keep him in power for some time?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, hackers stole $45 million from ATMs worldwide in a matter of hours. U.S. Attorney in Brooklyn Loretta Lynch said it was a flash mob job.
They're told where to stand. They're told where to start. They're told you're going to hit as many ATMs as possible. Once they get those pins, they become a criminal flash mob.
Former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford voted back into office after his notorious Appalachian Trail fiction and his Argentine affair. He won his old congressional district, beating Elizabeth Colbert Bush, sister of comedian Stephen Colbert. Colbert went on his late night show with this.
My sister
lost. How could this happen? I was so sure Lulu had won because CNN called it for Sanford.
Oh, boy. And in New York, the one World Trade Center building's tall silver spire was bolted into place today, bringing the height of the new structure to a symbolic 1,776 feet. NBC's Matt Lauer narrated from the 104th floor for the Today Show.
This thing is lowering into place, and apparently it's in right now.
And it's up to its full height there all these years after 9/11. We're looking at a week in the news. Benghazi, Israel hitting Syria, hackers hitting the banks, and more. David Sanger, the New York Times, is with us from Washington, chief Washington correspondent there. Elizabeth Sullivan is here, editorial page editor at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Jack Beatty's here. Calvin is calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Calvin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom. How you doing?
We're all right. What do you see?
Well, once again, we're the laughing stock of the country. Once again, people caring about who got that R in front of their name versus someone who can do good for our state here in South Carolina.
You're Mark talking Sanford. About Mark Sanford's reelection, in spite of everything.
It's despite of everything. Despite that, before, he was a terrible governor. Like I said, when it comes to everything that's good in the state, we at the bottom. For everything that's bad, we at the top. Makes no sense at all why they voted that man back in.
But
more police. Go ahead.
Well, just that. I mean, it's a strong Republican district. He's the Republican candidate, and you know, he says, "Look, I want to be a fiscal hawk in Washington." It looks like that put him right there, Calvin.
He wasn't a fiscal hawk here. Like I said, we failing at everything. We are a failed state here in South Carolina. And, I mean, the moral police that claim all these ethics and all that, they no longer have that to say now.
Yeah.
You know, because y'all went back and went against everything you claim you stood for as far as morality and all this. And, I mean, you just totally discredited everything y'all had there in that district and here in South Carolina. Like I said, it don't matter if Mickey Mouse runs. As long as he's a Republican, they will vote him back in every time.
Calvin, we've got it. Here's the former governor. And, of course, there was the lie about being on the Appalachian Trail back in 09 and the revelation of his affair in Argentina. But he was put back in office. Here he was Tuesday night. Well, here's Sanford.
I just want to acknowledge a God not just of second chances, but third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth chances. Because that is the reality of our shared humanity.
The reality of our shared humanity. David Sommer, how do you interpret it? And what's it going to mean in Washington? Sanford was not heavily supported by the National Republican organizations, but here he is coming back.
You know, this is going to put the Republicans in a really interesting and difficult spot. It's a little bit hard for elements of the party that want to run on sort of culture wars, family values kind of element to go see that, you know, he makes his comeback despite this. And I think that many of them are struggling with how to go deal with this. A number of them abandoned him during the course of the campaign, and now they're going to have to go deal with him back here in Washington. That said, he's going to attract an outsized amount of attention for the amount of influence he will have. And my guess is that the biggest adjustment is not going to be Washington adjusting to Mark Sanford. It's going to be Mark Sanford adjusting to the fact that as governor, you've got a lot more leeway than you do as a member of Congress. And that's going to, I think, over time, he's going to begin to ask himself whether or not the switch from executive back to the legislature was the right way to go. It's one of the reasons you see so many legislators these days abandon those posts to go run for governor.
Of course, his choices may have been limited after the whole
affair. His choices were quite limited. You know, it's astounding he pulled the thing off.
Elizabeth, what do you make of Mark Sanford's electoral voting box redemption here in South Carolina?
Well, I think it's fairly clear he was elected because of the R and not because of, you know, Mark Sanford. I mean, you know, he seemed to me to kind of be his own worst enemy even in this campaign. But not knowing exactly how that congressional district was drawn, I have to say that in general, I think we have a problem in this country with districts, congressional districts that are increasingly drawn by partisans to prevent there being competitive elections, to make sure that parties are assured of this seat or that seat, meaning that you do not have the same kind of contest in the center that you would if the district was competitive. In the Ohio context, this is very striking. And I think, I mean, this is something our editorial board has been discussing, seems to argue for, you know, a closer look at nonpartisan primaries so that you can get, you know, really get at more the center of the country instead of the extremists that promote gridlock in Washington.
Jack, it is amazing how often this comes up, the way districts have been drawn so that they're one party or the other, and the harder you are, the more likely you are to get in there. And, of course, Sanford's old district, very, very Republican.
Very Republican, and there is now in the whole Deep South only one white Democratic congressman. And, of course, 40 years ago, they were legion. And part of that is because African-American voters have been cabined in African-American districts that elect, African-American Democrats, which is fine for the Democrats, but it's changed the whole complexion of the party in the South. You know, I thought the quip of the week came from Gail Collins in the Times. She says, and what committee do you think Sanford will serve on? And she writes, please, God, let it be foreign affairs.
Okay, foreign affairs, Buenos Aires, here we come. Hey, speaking of foreign affairs and difficult ones, I want to go to Benghazi. We had the hearings. They got a lot of attention. The deputy chief of mission in Libya brought out to say that he was astonished when UN ambassador then Susan Rice described what went on as rolling out of the anti-Islamic video. Here we had Trey Gowdy, Republican congressman, South Carolina, in those hearings saying it was false early reports from the Obama administration about what had happened that damaged people's ability to trust their government. Here's Gowdy.
It always matters whether or not you can trust your government. And to the families, we're going to find out what happened in Benghazi, and I don't give a damn whose career is impacted. We're going to find out what happened.
Going to find out what happened there. The message is, this isn't over. Democrats said, well, this is all politics. This is about rolling this on toward 2014, 2016. Here's Elijah Cummings, representative of Maryland, accusing the Republicans of politicizing the attacks in Benghazi.
Let me be clear. I am not questioning the motives of our witnesses. I am questioning the motives of those who want to use their statements for political purposes.
David Sanger, how do you see the ratio of foreign policy insight and politics in the hearings this week?
I would say it's about 30 to 40% insight and about 60 to 70% politics at this point. But the politics have changed. In last year, when this happened and this great tragedy happened and the mistakes happened, and clearly you couldn't emerge from this testimony without thinking that this was mishandled on several grounds, and I'll come back to those in a minute, this was all about President Obama. When you looked at the politics of it this week, it was all about Hillary Clinton, and they were trying to turn this back to questions about decisions that she made, conversations she had, conversations that her chief of staff at the time had, and whether or not there was a conscientious effort to silence silence the several of the employees who were aware of the facts here. If there was such an effort, clearly that's over now. That's failed now because they're out describing what was a poor response to an unpredicted situation. That said, when you go back and you look at the set of new facts that we know this week, we don't know a whole lot of new facts. We've heard about some interesting conversations that took place that would raise the question of whether or not there was an active effort to call this something other than a terror attack. But I think most Americans, the moment they saw it, could see it as a terror attack. There was the testimony that you played there, which said that there was very little relationship between the video, which had been a big issue in Egypt that same day, and what happened in Libya and in Benghazi. Well, I think we've known that for some time. Although when our correspondent went out and found some of the people who had been behind the attack within a week of the time of the attack, they maintained that the video and things like it were part of their inspiration. Now, that may have been a story they made up at the time for the benefit of our reporter.
Who knows? I mean, this came up, the Hillary Clinton role in the hearings. We had Representative Paul Gosar, a Republican out of Arizona, who in the hearings, he played video of Hillary Clinton asking, you know, that famous testimony in January. What difference does it make? It was January 23rd in a Senate hearing. Gregory Hicks, the deputy chief of mission who was brought out here, responded in the hearings about why he thought it may have made a difference in the follow-up anyway. Hillary Clinton, then the congressman, then Hicks.
What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again.
Well, I'm really mad, but Mr. Hicks, could I give you the opportunity to respond to that question? What difference does it make?
I think the question is, what difference did it make?
Yep.
President Magariev was insulted in front of his own people, in front of the world. His credibility was reduced. His ability to lead his own country was damaged. He was angry. A friend of mine who ate dinner with him in New York during the UN season told me that he was still steamed about the talk shows 2 weeks later. And I definitely believe that it negatively affected our ability to get the FBI team quickly to Benghazi.
Gregory Hicks there responding to Hillary Clinton's testimony, saying that the Libyan president, who had asserted right away that it was terror, but then was up against these Susan Rice comments, may have dragged his feet on getting the FBI in there. Jack Beatty, is that the consequence we ought to be thinking about?
Well, it's a serious consequence, isn't it? I mean, there's just no question about that. And today's ABC today has some, they look at those talking points. They've got various copies of them. And in one iteration, it appears that the State Department was the extremely active in trying to change the talking points. One, in trying to diminish the idea that the embassy was unusually vulnerable. They didn't want, and the spokesperson in the email says, we don't want the Republicans digging around in this. And two, they didn't want the Al-Qaeda connection made explicit because, again, that looked like it was something that might discredit the president's claims about being on top of Al-Qaeda. This seems to me to be a damaging part of this hearing, that we need to find out more about this. How these talking points originated, and, you know, because now we have an answer. They did do some damage, at least in that man's judgment.
Elizabeth, how are you looking at all this? I mean, we've got lots of comments online here. Jeffrey says about the Benghazi hearings, the Federalists just keep lying to us. It has to stop. They work for us, not political parties. And I guess he's pointing there at the Obama administration. But here's another listener says, McConnell failed in making the GOP senatorial agenda to make Obama a one-term president. Now the right is trying to derail Hillary before the next primaries even start with fake outrage over Benghazi. Do you think this Benghazi issue has legs, Elizabeth? Legs, staying power enough to go in 2014, 2016, Hillary Clinton's presidential aspirations if she should unfold them?
I would feel better about the whole situation if I thought that, in fact, the purpose of these hearings, the purpose of hearing this emotional testimony from Gregory Hicks was to improve the way that we handle diplomatic security, to improve the way that we have communication between our diplomatic and military, to improve maybe our forward operating posture for the military so that we can protect our diplomats, who are, in fact, our frontline people, to try to avoid, you know, things blowing up in our faces. They have in Syria, where we're faced with no good options at all. But in fact, you know, just as Susan Rice's appearance on those talk shows was really for partisan political purposes, and, you know, we heard a new dimension on why that was a mistake in these hearings. I do think that clearly the timing of these hearings is geared to, you know, for political ends and not to, you know, improve how, you know, it's not, if it were structured to that, we would have different testimony. It would be broader. It would involve, you know, kind of what next questions. And I don't see that happening. And I find that troubling. And I agree with David Sanger when he said, you know, where, you know, if we are to intervene in Syria in some manner that bolsters an al-Qaeda presence there, or that blows up the whole region into a Sunni Shiite war, will we be back, you know, talking about some of these problems that we're not really addressing now?
Get to what matters. If I may, I want to turn quickly, David, from Benghazi to maybe right here to Boston. I mean, lots of testimony this week on the FBI, the Boston Police Commissioner in Washington talking about information sharing. Was there a failure? Is it clear here, David, a failure to communicate that might have otherwise performed led to stopping this bombing in Boston?
Tom, there may well have been in that the FBI information was not conveyed on to the Boston police. But, you know, let's suppose for a moment it had been. The information was that they couldn't find a particular threat from him. So I'm not sure that if the Boston police had been given this, as the Boston police commissioner himself admitted, that there necessarily would have been a whole lot of basis for them to move against him.
But lots of scrutiny of exactly what went on there before and around the marathon bombings in Boston. David Sanger with the New York Times, it's always great to have you. Thank you for your insights today, sir. Thanks for joining
us. Great to be back with you, Tom.
Elizabeth Sullivan at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Good luck to your city, and thanks for being with us, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, have a good weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.